sharp attorneys are a license to steal. When mama doesn't have capacity to do it, and they take advantage of it.
You're listening to Kirk Sanders, a fiduciary litigator and partner with the law firm Hendrick Bryant. Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
But I also see cases where huge swaths of money disappear. People pay off mortgages. It's follow the money. It's where's the money? What was taken? What did mama have before the bad guy took over?
In this episode, we discuss what happens when someone violates their financial fiduciary duty. When does it cross over from civil to criminal violations? How forensic accountants and examiners assist in fiduciary litigation, and what is required to be a good expert witness in court. He's a law graduate of Wake Forest University. He is a partner with Hendrick Bryant Law Firm. He concentrates in estate, trust, and fiduciary litigation. Kirk Sanders, welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Glad to be here, Robert.
How did you choose law as a profession?
By default and lack of planning. The year is 1992, Desert Storm's going on. I'm a political science major with a business minor. Hadn't thought about what I was going to do after graduation. And my parents thought I should go to law school, so I took the LSAT and applied to three schools and got in. It became a challenge because you always heard about people flunking out, and I didn't do great my first semester. I didn't quite figure out the program, but I figured it out second semester and moved on from there. Yeah, I didn't really have a plan. I didn't have a desire to be a prosecutor or anything like that. I just kind of fumbled into it.
And once you get out of law school, start practicing, you transition into trusts and estates. Why did you go into that area?
I came out of law school. I'm from Winston-Salem. I wanted to live in Raleigh. I wanted to live in Wilmington. It's 1995. Nothing really is going on in Winston back then. And my dad's like, I'm striking out in Raleigh and Wilmington. He lets me just go on a long rope, and he finally tells me at Christmas, hey, I know these 10 lawyers. Well, next thing you know, because I'm a Winston-Salem boy, I'm getting job offers. I stick around. Back then, I was a general practitioner, did some criminal, did some real estate, did some personal injury, you name it. And as time went on, I started narrowing my scope, realizing over time that there needs to be some focus. I kind of watched other firms and my friends that were there and how they became more successful. Heck, I went out on my own after 2 years and hung my own shingle. And I stumbled into some fiduciary litigation cases. And that's what we call this area, fiduciary litigation. It's involving money. It's involving duties, power of attorney abuse. It's will contest. It's trust disputes. It's estate mismanagement. But I did one in the 90s, and I didn't want to do it. Quoted the guy some what I thought was a silly figure. I'm like, I need a $10,000 retainer. I thought, there's no way this guy's going to do it. I didn't want the case. It was late on a Friday. Guy says, I'll FedEx it to you. You'll get it Monday. And I was like, oh boy. Well, that was my first one. Then I started doing a few more, just stumbling into them, not really making that what I was going to focus and let my name be known as. And an attorney at a large, large law firm, when I was telling her about one of my case victories, said, Kirk, fiduciary litigation. And I go, what's that? She goes, it's a burgeoning area of the law. It's all that estate disputes and all that that you're doing. I'm like, huh. Went back home, realized that it's all there. You got people living longer. You got people with dementia because they're living longer. You got families that are spread around. And here's the big kicker, too. You got second marriages. There's an inherent conflict, Robert, between the step-parent and the children of the first marriage. Because let's just say it's dad that dies. If dad leaves everything to stepmom outright, stepmom's going to leave it to her children or her family. And it'll never get seen by the children of the first marriage. Happens all the time. Unless you really do some solid planning. And it's just hard. It's hard, especially as people get older. Suddenly, the undue influence, the capacity issues that get taken advantage of. All right, that's how I got into it, and I could go on and on, but I said, man, that's the area. Let me do it. And so I focused, and I started looking for cases.
So fiduciary litigation is just someone taking over the financial affairs or other affairs of another person, and they're just doing a bad job at it, or they're cheating. Is that really what it is?
That's the general overarching. So if you think about the fiduciary, power of attorneys are fiduciaries. They got a duty, and the duty is best interest, that they got to act in the best interest of the principal or the old person that signed the power of attorney. Trustees are fiduciaries. They're supposed to be a prudent investor and distribute funds properly. Estate executors are also fiduciaries. That's the general overarching. But then there's also the disputes over when somebody gets mama or grandma or whatever to do a will or a trust when mama doesn't have capacity to do it, and they take advantage of it, usually with undue influence, and one person in particular benefits to the detriment of others. So that's all part of fiduciary litigation.
When your clients come to you, what's the most common reason?
The most common reason is that either they know in advance, or that family member, whether it's usually a parent, has died. And at the time they've died, someone steps up and goes, well, I've got a will. And usually the will was done within the last year, maybe 2 years of the person's life. And looks like I'm getting everything. And that's when they call me up and go, wait a second. We got big problems. Dad hasn't been in his right mind for 3 years. Or dad had a severe stroke and could barely talk. That's when I get that call. And I can usually tell, if they'll let me ask them the questions and won't try to tell me the whole story on the telephone, I can usually tell in 5 minutes or less if it's a good case or not.
Right. It reminds me, and I'm dating myself, of the litigation of Anna Nicole Smith, where they had this 80-year-old guy that she married, and for some reason the children were saying there were some shenanigans going on. Is that what you're saying?
Uh-huh. Yeah, Anna Nicole Smith was definitely a fiduciary litigation matter, or her husband, that Texas oil tycoon. Yes, sir.
When your client comes to you, what are they asking you to do? Are they asking you to sue a family member or sue the trustee? What exactly are they trying to get out of this?
Okay, so I'm gonna step aside from the will contest and the trust, because you're talking to, you want to ask me about CPAs and forensic accounting. So I'm going to stick to, I get this call, and this may be more on point here for you. I get a call and they go, hey, sometimes it's a neighbor or sometimes it's a child, and they say, hey, my brother or my sister is in charge of my mom's money. They're the power of attorney. And they're not, something's going wrong. They don't have a job, but they just bought a new car.
Mm-hmm.
Warning sign.
Yes.
Or they've added on to their house, or they're taking trips that they've never taken before, but they won't show us mom's accounts. And I go, oh, yeah, you got a case. And the longer those cases go, the more the money gets spent. Now, if they're taking trips, you're never going to see that money again. But I also see cases, I cannot talk in detail, so I'm just going to talk in generalities, where huge swaths of money disappear. People pay off mortgages, that sort of thing. It's fascinating. Then there's people that just change accounts. But yeah, it's follow the money. It's where's the money? What was taken? What did mama have before the bad guy took over?
Do you have to sue the person before you can start doing subpoenas or trying to find out where the money went to?
You definitely have to file litigation. It used to be harder. We have corrected, thanks to some of the estate planning groups of the North Carolina Bar Association. They realized we got a severe problem. Power of attorneys, and I was one of the people saying way back, I go, power of attorneys are a license to steal. And there was almost no way to challenge mama's incompetent, your sibling's stealing from her. Who has standing? who can bring that case? Well, now they're letting family members demand accountings on behalf of mama because of the new laws on power of attorneys. I have rarely found a demand letter works. It is giddy up, file it, file what's called Liz Pendens, send out discovery, and go at ramming speed. That's the only way to get these things resolved.
What happens if a person is defrauded or by a relative or a close associate? How do you get the money back for them or their heirs?
If they're spending it as they go, you know, I told you a lot of these cases, someone's on disability or hadn't worked in a couple of years, and they're just living off of it. Man, once that money is spent, you'll never get it back, but you get them out of the position. On the other ones, you know, they paid off a house. Well, now we're going to, because you use mama's money to pay off the house, I'm going to file what's called a Liz Pendens or a notice of litigation pending and freeze that house up. So nobody will refinance. Nobody will accept a deed on that house. And at the end of the day, if my clients prevail, we're going to go in and grab that house and sell it to get some money back.
So the ultimate goal is to find assets that have been purchased or used that you can claw back and then identify them, get them to where they're in a holding pattern where no one can use it or abuse it or misuse it, and then get a judge to give you some type of judgment. Would that be correct?
Somewhere in between there, in a lot of these cases, one of my number one goals will be an injunction, a temporary restraining order, then an injunction. The main goal is remove that fiduciary from that role and put an independent person in there. That's usually job number one, because at least we're stopping anything else from vanishing.
How long does it usually take? It's like a month, a year?
Okay, and the fiduciary violations matters, you're usually looking fast, but usually 6 months. And the reason why they wrap up pretty fast is normally these cases are pretty damning. And it's hard to say that paying off a $200,000 mortgage was in mama's best interest when it was your mortgage. So, but people on the other side, the bad actors, they don't consider themselves thieves. They will rationalize what their position is. So sometimes you got to just get them in a deposition and wrap their heads a few times with a hard stick before their attorney can finally say, hey, we need to get this done. That's kind of how I see these things going.
Is there ever a criminal prosecution that happens because of this? I mean, I understand abusing the POA and it's a fiduciary responsibility, but at what point in time does it cross over the line into something that's criminal?
It is every bit a criminal act. And there's laws called exploitation of an elderly person, which includes also people with mental handicaps too. And it's a felony. And there's a whole, depending on how much, it goes from F on down. But I see law enforcement currently, for the most part, it's not in their wheelhouse, so they avoid it. And their standard phrase is, that's a civil matter. But I am starting to see a couple of cases, and I'm not going to comment, but there are matters right now where they're prosecuting that fiduciary. I'd like to see more of that, because these people need prosecution. There needs to be some, it needs to be publicized.
You think it's a matter of proving intent or willfulness that they intended to defraud the, we'll just call it elderly person for just for sake of our argument. Is that what it is? Or law enforcement doesn't want to get into the idea of, well, you know, mama said I could have this house, so therefore I took it, even though it's being the mom's not capable of testifying in court, because ultimately you got to have some type of witness on the stand going, yes, this happened to me and it shouldn't have happened to me.
Yeah, and well, let's look at it. Typically, mama is incompetent and dependent on this fiduciary. So, you know, either they're wheelchair bound and need the fiduciary to get them to the groceries and get them to the doctors. And so they're scared to upset the apple cart. Or two, they're over there and they're just producing carbon dioxide and they don't know what's going on. But yeah, what you hear the fiduciary will say was, mama said I could have this. Mama wanted to reward me for helping her out. Well, then where's the attorney drafted document saying, I hereby give the fiduciary this in great gratitude? Where is that? And it's not there. Putting words in mama's mouth should not count.
When do you hire outside help when you get a case like this? Tell me the story or the plan of you see something. How would you go get outside help, and what kind of outside help would you get to help you find these assets and have the right person possess them again?
There's two different avenues on that, Robert. So there's the consultation help, and there's the, okay, I'm going to call you an expert and designate you as an expert in this case. I mean, but there's two different avenues we look at. Well, a lot of times you start with a consulting expert, and it's going to be a CPA. Now, occasionally you might say, hey, look, for consultation purposes and to keep the money expenses down for the client, let's go with a solid bookkeeper if they're not going to testify. But when you come to testifying, and you got to think about that, is this, am I going to need this consultant to tilt over to designated expert? Then you might as well go straight to the CPA. You want to have that CPA just because of the requirements now for expert testimony. I'm sure people in the past on this podcast have talked about the Daubert standards that came out, and that North Carolina and pretty much a lot of the states have expressed that there's more scientific testimony. Back to this, I've got cases where some cases are just blatant, and it's like, I don't need a CPA. It's obvious. And then there's some cases where the money goes from one account to another account, and either another account, and then it ends up in the bad guy's account. But it takes a circuitous route, and without seeing checks, you just see these deposits or these withdrawals, and you're like, well, that's a similar amount, and that's in a similar time period. I'm going to need a consultant, ultimately an expert, to tie that up and say, let me show you the trail.
And when you hire these consultants, are you looking for we talked about a CPA license. Does it matter if it's a CPA? Does it matter to you if it's somebody else? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out the idea. I know credentialing is very important in court. And does the CPA license by itself okay with the judge, or do they ask you for more credentials than that?
You always look at, there's the test. Does this proposed expert have greater knowledge of this topic than the jury, or I guess rephrase it, could the jury come to their own conclusions by seeing this data? Does the expert bring something else, some greater knowledge that's applied to scientific methodology? That's the great test for a judge. So if it's just a show and tell, probably not going to get the CPA in there. But if it requires, let me show you how this was done. The CPA, and the reason you need someone, they got to have experience. Well, why, expert, are you better than a juror at figuring this out?
When I hear the word CPA or the initial CPA, I think auditing, reviews, compilations, some tax returns. I'm not thinking trace the money through three different corporations to find out where it went to, ultimately the disposition of it. When I hear the word CPA, that's what I think of in generic sense. I don't think the forensics accounting side of it. Maybe there is, and I know there's a designation for it, but I wasn't sure if when you hire CPAs, is it someone who has the experience where they're tracing money and that's what they do? It's not just an auditor who decides to become a forensic accountant one day and say, I want to do this.
What I can't have a guy that just does taxes and say, hey, I need you to audit this and trace it. I need a guy or gal with auditing experience that's seen problems and said, there's a bookkeeping error. There's something here. They trigger something. They've got an experience. They can tell people, hey, I've done this before. And they got to come to the table with experience. If they don't have experience, I can't use them.
Gotcha. So it's really a CPA with a certain experience, not just the license itself.
Yeah. So I guess this boils down to, and I think you're probably going to ask me this later, what do I look for in this forensic accounting expert?
That was my next question, actually. So what do you look for in a forensic accounting expert?
look, I need to tell you this. So what I'm looking for, one, number one, I'm going to get on a soapbox and say, I don't want a hired gun. Do not tell me what I want to hear just to tell me what I want to hear, because it's going to be a house of cards and they're going to destroy us. And I've had it happen before. I had it happen in a Med-Mal case. And my expert got out Arkansas, and the guy had been just telling me everything I wanted to hear. And once he got put under oath, he was the most worthless waste of my money. And I was very irritated. So I want people that tell me the good, the bad, and the ugly of my case. But when I'm looking for them, price is one thing. You know, on a forensic accountant, I can't spend on most of these cases. The person's already sucking wind. I can't spend 10 grand just to get some answers. I need to be able to have someone that can say, hey, look, I can look at this thing. I'm used to doing this. Give me a few hours. Pay me for a few hours time. Let me see if things are popping out at me, and then I'll report back.
Right. So it's almost like looking into the hood of a car. Let me look in to see what you may have a problem. I can point you in the right direction.
Exactly. How's it sound? Ooh, I know where that noise is coming from. I want to hear that before I dive too deep. And so that's number one. I want them to have some experience. I look for someone to also teach me, because I have seen it. I've experienced it where the CPA, the forensic expert, will say, you need to ask their expert the following questions. And to hit these topics, they're not going to be able to answer these. And that's valuable. So I go in and I have the expert's agenda from their perspective, because that's not what I do. And those experts are super valuable. I've seen that. I had a personal injury case. The expert came back to see the other expert testify. And right before cross, 15 minutes, it just took 15 minutes back at the courtroom, said, ask this, this, and this. Went back up there, you know, ran through the questions and got to those questions, dismantled the other side's expert.
It's the ability to see both sides of the argument and the weaknesses. Because every case has got a weakness and a strength. So it's a matter of saying, hey, here's the weaknesses you may have to exploit.
And Robert, I want credible experts. Like you just said, every case has a couple dings, a couple holes. I don't want an expert that tries to just explain away everything or evade it. Sometimes you got to go, yeah, I agree, that's a problem, and move on. But if you try to fight them on it, everyone's going to pay attention that, hey, you don't want to answer that. This must be important. So take your lumps and move the heck along. Somebody that's going to know what they're looking for, and almost they're going to ask me some questions about the case, get a pretty quick feel for it and go, I know what I'm looking for. Just give me a couple hours to just get that overview, that, hey, you know, let's look under the hood moment. And then as they come back in, dive deep. I'm looking for an expert that can do a report, because these cases are going to need a report. In North Carolina, reports by experts aren't required. They are in federal court. But in a case like this, you better have a report. We need an exhibit to submit to the court, submit to the jury to go by, even if it gives the other side a roadmap of where we're going. We need to know, well, how much money's missing, how much money was misappropriated, which accounts did it come from. That's what I want. So they got to write a good report. They got to get it done on time. And they got to be able to show the jury, lead the jury, answer questions, and be somewhat interesting in a dry topic.
No, I understand. Accounting is not everybody's forte. There's a reason why they hire accountants. How do you find the experts that you need? Is it by, I'm assuming you don't Google them. I'm assuming you go to the attorney who's had the same problem and you say, hey, who'd you use? I mean, how do you find the experts that you need?
I have Googled around before. I'm very wary of that. I want to know from people, you know, that have used somebody. So I had a construction litigation case years back. I called around and around and around because I didn't want I wanted someone beyond just a standard auditor or whatever. I needed someone that knew construction. And I got one of those people, and it was the CFO of a construction company. But I got it through my leads, and some people said, hey, that guy will be pretty good.
So it's through word of mouth?
It's pretty much through word of mouth. I try to build up a expert logbook for different topics. You know, it's just people that sometimes different groups of lawyers will have a little seminar and they'll say, hey, I use so-and-so and so-and-so, really good. I want an expert that if here's the other thing. Let me mention this. I don't want an expert that's just an expert. They better have a day job because otherwise they look like they're a hired gun. They need to be able to say, you know, this is what I do for a living. I do audits. I also do forensic accounting, but I do audits. I don't just testify all the time. I also want the expert, not so much in forensic accounting, but they need to go both ways. They don't need to be always a plaintiff's expert or always a defense expert.
Are there any other expertise that you're looking for in particular? I'm just thinking out loud here. Digital forensics, like what's on an email? Do emails and cell phones make a difference in your type of litigation?
They are. One admission I'm going to make is I've only recently come into the e-discovery where I've got an e-discovery platform, and we're still working with that to learn how to do that. I've been an old school paper discovery attorney where I like to look through them in big notebooks, but I got to get to that point. And I can tell you, I don't know how to look for digital fingerprints. Don't know how. So I need to find some of those folks. I don't know those folks, but a lot of mine come down to some text messages and come down to some emails, and I need to see, have someone help me on those. But I'm clueless as where to start on that one.
The reason why I was asking that question is whether or not grandma said this happened or mama said this happened, and maybe you're trying to refute it or corroborate it. And there, it may be some type of forensic evidence that needs to be taken off a computer or off of a cell phone or something of that nature, whether or not that's needed in litigation and in which fiduciary litigation or not.
It's mostly like communications back and forth. Hey, what's going on with mom's money? None of your business is the text back. And so just a bunch of screenshots.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Okay. So it's usually the victim or someone on behalf of the victim inquiring and you get an answer.
I'm not using digital forensics to figure out where to follow the money trail.
If someone wanted to get into this line of work where they just say, hey, fiduciary litigation, that's my jam. That's what I just love. And they're a forensic accountant or forensic examiner, how would they best market themselves to fiduciary litigators like yourself?
I'll tell you, number one, what they shouldn't do, don't email me. Don't email me because I'm going to assume it's spam. The easiest thing is, and I got in early on the internet and started blogging on this, and so I developed some good SEO. Since then, others have gamed it up and have come into the space more, but I would be Googling fiduciary litigation attorneys, and you're going to hit a bunch and just go page after page and take down those firms' names and write them a letter, stick in a business card, and tell me a little bit about what you've done. And hey, you might as well tell me some of your rates too, because I'm going to ask, or I'm going to ignore it unless you show me what your rates are. So send me a letter in the U.S. mail.
Tell me about a case in which a financial investigation was needed that somehow made a difference in your career or somehow sticks out in your mind.
There's this thing called an interpleader. Someone's holding on to money and they go, hey, I'm holding on to this money. There's two people here or three people that all have claims to this money. Court, tell me what to do. There's some cases where I interplead, which is I'm representing a person. They're a subsequent fiduciary. Let's say they're the successor trustee. They're the court-appointed trustee to come take over a case because the first trustee, and we'll call that person Trustee A, was removed because they weren't acting in fiduciary best interest of the beneficiary of the trust. So now comes the new trustee. They've done everything. They've collected all the assets. It's time to trigger the distribution to the heirs. And oh, by the way, Trustee A is one of those beneficiaries. Now, successor trustee looks at me and goes, I got these funds. They're going to fight over it. No one will accept. Here's my report. I think for a fact that X dollars were misappropriated by Trustee A. Now, there's a section of B dollars that's great, probably, but I'm not sure. I don't have enough to tell me what was bad, whether this was bad money or good money, you know, had reasonable expenses on the best interest of the principal. So all these heirs, they're fighting. They won't agree to the successor trustee's report. They're like, oh, hell no. And they're fighting over that gray money. So I get hired. I file a suit. I say, court, here's the money. Tell us how to distribute it. Now, I've been in cases where the beneficiaries drug me in to try to prove the gray area, and I'd rather let them fight over that.
Right. So in this situation, when you're representing trustee B or the successor trustee, you have to go to the court and say, this is what we think it is. But when you hire outside help to help you make that determination, do you have to get the court's permission to get outside help? How does that work?
That would actually be a really good way to do it. Say, okay, the beneficiaries will not agree to my report as successor trustee. So they can either choose to fight amongst themselves, and here's the money, y'all go at it, or B, as trustee, I'm going to hire a forensic accountant. I'm going to let them go to town. You guys better participate and give them the documents the forensic auditor is looking for. And then once that report comes in, I'm submitting it to the court and asking the court to approve that amount. What the successor trustee wants to avoid is distributing based on his or her plan and have one of the beneficiaries come back and sue him for a breach of fiduciary duty for giving the other side too much. It's a cover his ass or her ass move.
Does trustee B hire the forensic accountant, or does the court hire the forensic accountant?
The court has no say in that. The trustee B will have to ask the court for permission to spend funds, unless it's in the trust document. Trustee B is going to petition the court for an order saying, hey, look, let's hire an independent forensic accountant or auditor to figure out an answer.
Have you ever had a situation where all the beneficiaries agree to have one party figure it all out? It's almost like a mediation type of thing.
Yeah, that happens a lot. That's the reasonable way, but you know, you got to also keep in mind, what are we dealing with? We're dealing with family. So once you add that family factor, you throw a large chunk of reasonable behavior out the window.
The scenario that you're giving me is the trustee needs to hire a forensic accountant, peel back the onion and find out where the money went to and who should get what slice. And then the question would be is, I guess they can petition the judge to authorize that disbursement, or we can get all the parties together and agree to one person figuring it all out, and then they can, I guess, agree or disagree with the report itself.
That's right. And now, typically, they're never going to agree, even though part A, where the successor trustee petitions the court, find me an independent person, those beneficiaries are never going to be happy with the report.
No, just because of there's a lot of emotions involved. I completely understand that.
Yeah, they're always going to think someone's still hiding something. Probably true.
Are there any resources or training that have helped you on your journey?
Experience. You know, you go to continuing legal education classes, but until you take one of these cases on and slug it out, you don't learn. There's no better tool than experience. When I first started CLEs or continuing legal education, they used to be rather dry and boring. I'd say in the last 15 years, they've all, for the most part, stepped up. And so also we'll look at those classes that really fit my interest versus I'm taking this just to get my required time in. It's the talk at these live ones when you're sitting around at lunch and you're talking to attorneys that have also had other experiences. You learn from their war stories, and the war stories are where, quite frankly, I've learned most of it and how to get things done and how to do it. Because all you need is an idea, and then you work with the mechanics.
What do you wish you have known when you started?
When I came out, I had no idea what I wanted to practice. So I did general practice, and the general practice has been the dying area of the law probably since 1990. So it took me a while to develop my niche. So I wish I had greater guidance, a better mentor to say, here's, you need to focus on a niche. Look at these niches. They're the future.
Looking back in your career as a fiduciary litigator, what do you think is your biggest mistake or lost opportunity?
The ones I regret would come down to picking cases. And after you get enough experience, you kind of get this little alarm that goes off in the back of your head, that tingle. And there's been times I ignored that. And when I ignored that, I rued the day I took that case, whether it was because my client was a total jerk and just stole part of my life, or it was a really bad case. And I'll give you an example. When I first got married, I come back to the house. I've lost my second jury trial. And I'm going to tell you, both the cases I lost were bad cases. There's a reason they got to all the way to the trial. It's because they didn't have settlement value. And I come in, I'm sitting on the sofa, and my wife looks at me and she goes, you need to pick your cases better.
And it's affecting her day.
My first reaction was to argue back. And it took me about a split second to go, you know what? She's right. Pick your cases better. And so, by God, it's a lot better when you pick a good case. And I've got enough years under my belt that you can almost soothsay where the case is going to end up and how it's going to work out. It's not perfect, but you get a pretty good idea after 25 years. So my biggest mistake, not picking the right case, is not listening to my gut. And I'm going to tell you, there's clients that no amount of money would have been worth taking their case on because they stole part of my soul.
Not every client is worth the same amount of money.
Amen.
You could do an hourly rate of, let's say, $500, and some clients are worth it, and some clients are just not worth it. It's just not. The headache value is not worth it.
No, they will wear you down, and they'll break you down, and then there's less of you to go around for your other clients.
You're robbing your other, your good-paying clients because you have to deal with the client that's just a headache, for sure.
And back to it, sometimes I like to tell my clients the God honest truth. Here's the problem with your case. Here's the beautiful part of your case. That's the same thing I want to know from my expert. If it comes down to bottom line litmus, you know, I want experience and I want them to tell me like it is. I brought in a forensic accountant on a business litigation matter, but it had gotten way too personal for my client. And my client kept saying, oh, there's been mishandling of money and invoices are wrong and this didn't happen. And the guy comes back, the expert, and goes, Kirk, I'm just not seeing it. I'm not seeing it. I mean, pennies. No, this thing's pretty clean. I tell my client that. My client goes, oh, no. There's something wrong. So we all get in there together, expert, client. We even have my client's personal attorney in there. And I let my client talk me and my expert into continuing on in that litigation. It was an arbitration matter. Against both of our instincts and research in the case, you know how that case ended up.
Nothing there, huh?
Yeah, we lost. We lost. And then, what do I hate? I hate to lose.
Well, sometimes you only learn when you lose. Unfortunately, sometimes we know going into the game that we're going to lose, but we play the game anyways.
Oh, I've been there where I'm like, why bother going back to court tomorrow? Because I've already lost.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hey, I'm telling you, the ones I've lost, I win more than I lose, okay? But you know, you tell the war stories and you remember the ones you lost and you don't celebrate the ones you won enough. So anyway.
Just true. You learn more from losing than you do winning. But it's okay. It's absolutely just fine. All right, final four questions. You ready for the final four?
Sure.
You're a partner in a law firm. What is your biggest motivation now?
I like a challenge. I like to see something new, figure it out, solve the problem. I had an old associate who said, I love mayhem. So I love to break things and then put them back together.
So continue what you're doing?
Continue what I'm doing. I love when there's a new case, I go, wow, I haven't seen this type of case yet. It still happens every so often. You'll get a case and you're like, don't know where this one's going to end up. It might end up in the Court of Appeals. That sounds fun.
What book or books have changed your thinking or your life?
This is a really sad answer, but first year of law school, the law books that we had to read because, and I don't know if this is positive, but I went from being a guy that had an entrepreneurial spirit, still do, to looking at things and assessing their liability, so the liability of an action. When you're reading about court cases, something went wrong.
Share something that you've purchased in the last 12 months, less than 100 hours now, that you enjoyed or made your job easier. If it's good enough for Kirk, it should be good enough for the world.
You know, a lot of people use Adobe Acrobat. There's also this Nuance program. It's their Nuance Power Converter, PDF. It's a 3-in-1. That sucker, you can do everything you can with Adobe Acrobat, but it also converts documents into Word and things like that. It's just been a handy little tool.
And it's called what again?
Nuance. And it's some sort of like Power PDF. It's got a 3-in-1 program that you buy. Power PDF, something converter, and I couldn't tell you what else. I just call it Nuance. Nuance.
If you had to do something else, you got fired today, what would you be doing?
Well, it may not pay, but I'd like to do some screenwriting again.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, back when I was a single man and had time and energy, I'd write screenplays. And I wrote one really bad novel that no one will ever read.
Did you ever get it published?
Again, no. When I say no one will ever read, I mean I won't allow anyone to ever read it. It's that bad. It was fiction.
What was the plot line?
I wrote it back in 2000. It was about a person winning the lottery, but they were such a scoundrel. They'd run out on their wife and children, and they had a bunch of people looking for them. They double-crossed so many people that they were hiding out, but they won the lottery, so they were having a problem. How do they collect their lottery winnings? Because when they show up to collect their lottery winnings, everyone and their brother's going to come after him, and there's one or two people that are going to try to kill him.
Once he gets all the money, he becomes more of a target.
His whole thing is laying low.
Well, Kirk, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I do appreciate it. Best wishes on your law practice. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.